ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
And this week it's dark times for Australian scripted drama, while shiny floor shows and sport reign supreme in Aussie TV.
And a popular streaming service is joining Australian rating systems for the first time. But first, to the courts. Tim, there's a potential court case brewing which could threaten Google's hold, and what a hold it is, on the digital advertising market.
It does feel like sometimes we talk about nothing but court cases all around the world involving Google and Meta, certainly the big platforms. This latest development is that Google may face a class action from Australian businesses. Australian law firm Slater & Gordon is investigating what it's saying is alleged anti-competitive behaviour in the Australian advertising market. And I suppose we just have to sort of think about the sheer context and size of Google, because we think of it as a search platform, but it's so much more. It powers so much of the digital advertising system locally.
Why would Australian businesses want to take this on? Not just because it feels like a David and Goliath battle, but for some businesses, Google has helped them get in front of more consumers than ever, more potential customers than ever. So what is the real crux of this issue? Why are they mad at a platform that would argue back, we've helped you a lot?
Well, I suppose that absolutely is the crux of it. Because it helps, you have to use it. If you're a small business owner, you know, there aren't many choices. Maybe Meta and the Facebook and Instagram platforms, but that's about it. So that, of course, gives enormous pricing power to these organisations, which small businesses can't negotiate with. So the argument being it will need some sort of court intervention to decide whether the power in the market being exercised by Google is fair or not.
These small businesses, though, a lot of them used to support the likes of the local classifieds, the local papers, ads on local television networks. They don't do that as much anymore, and it's hard for some people to work out whether it's a chicken or the egg. You know, did those traditional mediums start declining and so businesses had to put their ad dollars elsewhere? Or did they start putting their ad dollars elsewhere and now they've got no alternative and they're kind of stuck with Google?
I suppose that's the thing. Every monopoly starts somewhere. It doesn't start off as a monopoly. Whether that makes me on team chicken or team egg, I'm not quite sure, Viv. But I suppose the point worth making is this is something which is, it's unfolding all around the world. In recent months, we've seen a big case going on in the US around Google's power in the search market and those ads that sit there next to when you search for something. And you can follow a link out to a business if you want. And that has been found to be a monopoly. So where we're at with that one overseas is what the remedies will be. And that could yet be Google selling parts of its business, so splitting itself up.
Those parts of the business being the likes of YouTube or its ad sales business. How would that even look in reality? It feels a bit of a pipe dream. We've failed so catastrophically in some senses to regulate big tech. And now we're talking about this pipe dream of breaking up one of the biggest companies the world has ever seen.
And remember, it's Chrome, it's the Android phone, it's all these other things. But if YouTube was separate, arguably it could create itself a really amazing search platform all of its own. That's just one example where it would compete with itself. So we'll have to see whether it happens. These things take a really long way to play out. But whichever way it goes, I think the times are finally starting to change in the world of digital advertising. Netflix has announced this week that its audience figures will be publicly available in Australia as they sign up to the local TV measurement system, Oztam.
It's an interesting call, and it is the first time a streamer has done it in Australia. So it's unusual for a streamer, which has previously been so cloak and dagger about its real viewing figures, to not only engage with showing the reality of its viewing numbers, but to do so via such a traditional and legacy medium. Tim, I am a little confused by this move, I have to admit.
I think the answer, as it so often is when it comes to media, Viv, is money. If Netflix wants to bring in the advertisers locally, because it now has advertising on one of its tiers of its offering, it needs to persuade those advertisers that it's finding an audience. So it has to demonstrate that. So using the existing rating system is one way of doing so.
I guess they don't want to be accused of marking their own homework, which is something that the likes of Facebook and other Meta properties are often accused of, where they only release certain data about the reality of what's happening on their platforms. And then people say, well, you just made that up. I've got no way to verify that, no way to check it. I remember years ago when some astronomical claims were being made about how many people were viewing video on Facebook. And then when people started questioning that, you could almost flick or scroll past something. And if your eye happened to glance it out of the corner for half a second, you were counted as a view. It does feel, so I'm glad they're not doing that, but it does feel a bit strange that they're joining a legacy system, which is questioned quite a lot anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, the platforms do love a walled garden, but the difference with Oztam is the way that it came about was it was created by all of the broadcasters, so it's still to this day owned by 7, 9 and 10. But the media agencies, the people who buy the ads on behalf of the big advertisers, they had a vote in it as well. So they agreed on the system. And of course, we have to remember, it's not as if our television is somehow sending a signal to the networks on what we're actually watching. There are a bunch of set-top boxes around the country which Oztam is able to kind of see what's going on, and from that they then extrapolate what's actually going on to get that ratings number. And of course, when you then get into streaming, that's even harder to calculate. Whichever way the ratings cookie crumbles, we're starting to learn more, though, about the on-the-ground impact of the streaming services.
And in a moment, dire numbers for TV spending on drama and children's content domestically.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
New numbers from the Australian Communications and Media Authority have given us something of a window into how the big commercial television stations are spending their money, Viv.
Yes, spending on Australian drama in the 2023 to 2024 financial year has gone down slightly, but compared to 6 years ago, it has decreased by 49%. Australian light entertainment has had a good year, though, jumping to just over $577 million spent.
And a similar number spent on sport as well, down a little from last year, but still over $560 million. Meanwhile, children's Australian drama, nowhere near that. $1.75 million spent on it. And that was actually up on the previous year.
One of the people with a keen eye on the way our networks splash the cash is Professor Anna Potter at the Queensland University of Technology's School of Communication. Anna, were you surprised by the numbers in the report?
No, I wasn't remotely surprised given the policy changes that have occurred in the last 3 years, particularly the removal of any meaningful obligations to do either Australian drama or Australian children's. So these numbers reflect basically what happens when you put children's and Australian drama into a policy limbo, and that's a free fall in production and a free fall in spending. So I wasn't surprised, I was disheartened, but unsurprised because commercial broadcasters' businesses are under enormous pressure. They're facing existential threats and they're making sensible commercial moves to try to ensure their survival, and that's reflected in those programming budgets.
Well, Anna, before we drill into that aspect a little bit more, can you explain what the obligations broadly were and what they are now, and why did they change?
Before 2021, all three commercial broadcasters, so that's 7, 9 and 10, had to do a minimum of 32 hours a year each of new Australian drama for children. And they had to do around 100 hours each a year of Australian drama for general audience or adult audiences. And those changed. I mean, they've resented those obligations for years because they're high cost, and children's particularly, they couldn't put ads around it. No child in this country is really watching commercial broadcasting live to air in any meaningful amount. And so they'd always resented those policy obligations. And as their businesses became under pressure, their lobbying efforts increased. And in 2021, well, there was the children's quotas were suspended in 2020 by the Morrison government. And then those obligations were reworked in 2021 to basically water down all those what we call sub-quota obligations for children, drama and documentary. They were watered down to such a meaningless extent that they could fill them with one series of a long-running and profitable soap like Home and Away or Neighbours. So COVID was perhaps the last nail in the coffin, but certainly the networks had been lobbying very hard for a long time to be relieved of those high-cost scripted Australian content obligations.
Anna, it's a totally different landscape now, though. Back in 2013, when the makers of Offspring killed off Dr. Patrick, that was a cultural moment that everybody watched. I mean, I know people who took the next day off work to mourn Dr. Patrick's fictional death.
Spoiler.
It was a traumatic moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the spoiler is over by now. It's been, you know, 12 odd years, Tim, but sorry, it was a very sad moment. And I don't think that would happen now. It feels like the only way that the commercial free-to-air broadcasters can get people to sit in front of the television all at one time is the likes of a dinner party or a reunion for Married at First Sight. So, you know, is this the fault of the broadcasters, or is this partly audience trends and behaviours where we're not sitting down at the same time to watch drama?
I think that's a really good question, because in a way it's the fault of both. Like, certainly, obviously, now that we have abundant platforms and so many choices about where we put our eyeballs, audiences have, well, we used to say fragmented, but now we're pretty much saying audiences have atomized, and they're not watching, they're choosing not to watch drama on linear free-to-air TV, as we know. They're watching, preferring to watch it on streamers on demand. And so audiences' habits have changed enormously, and that has, I think last year was the first year that less than half of adults in Australia were watching free-to-air TV at all. So audiences' habits have changed because there's been such a proliferation in services. But also, I mean, the commercial networks did quite a good job of killing off drama in terms of scheduling it on what were then new multi-channels from 2009, promoting it poorly. You know, Neighbours lost half its audience when it moved from 10 to what was then 11. So they could make mount the argument then, oh, well, audiences don't want to watch drama, you know, partly because they can't find it and it's poorly promoted. But also audiences' habits changed. We had the reality TV juggernauts starting in the early 2000s, and they sort of eclipsed the success of everything else. So you had a combination of technology transforming how we consume our media diet and greatly increasing our choices, and networks pretty much sabotaging drama to ensure that they could effectively mount that argument that it wasn't popular with local audiences. And Offspring was one of the last really long-running, high-volume drama series to be given the axe.
And I suppose, and maybe I might challenge you a bit, because I'm sure they would, on the question whether it was deliberately sabotaged. I suppose I sort of look back, and I was trying to sort of get a sense of, okay, well, what was audience taste maybe 20 years ago, maybe 10 years ago? And it felt like what Australia was watching a lot of on free-to-air 20 years ago were big US shows. So this was just as Grey's Anatomy and Lost and Desperate Housewives had all been hits. But then if you sort of fast-forwarded another 10 years, so till about 10 years ago, that was the moment when actually there was some popular Australian drama. Things like Underbelly, for instance, was mm-hmm. for a brief yes. period, was huge. Is it also an aspect of just changing taste for the audiences, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point, Tim. It wasn't just the networks trying to sabotage the success of drama. because, as you say, Underbelly, which was only a very short duration, I think, but that did pretty well at the time. So, people's tastes have changed. There's much more choice. As you say, there was some very good drama coming out of the US. You know, there's great series like Lost and Desperate Housewives that audiences really embraced. So, yes, audiences' tastes have changed and they have far more choice. And Australian drama just became too expensive relative to the ad revenue that it could attract. There was also a policy change that didn't help. And that was if networks put their Australian drama on what were then new multi-channels that audiences weren't very familiar with, they got double the points towards filling their quota obligations. So the government, in an effort to make people embrace new digital multi-channels, the government put in place this incentive, which actually backfired because it took drama out of those main channels' high visibility. So that was a policy change that had unintended consequences as well.
Our guest is Professor Anna Potter from the Queensland University of Technology's School of Communication. We've seen some headlines this week about a really, really big audience numbers for State of Origin, which was this week. What is it that the networks like so much about sport?
Well, I think what you've just said, Tim, that it attracts high, it's one of the few reliable means of attracting high-ish audiences. And not just for the networks, obviously, but for the streamers as well, and for companies like, for operators like Stan. Sport reliably brings in big numbers, as does reality, as you said, Vivian, Married, you know, formats like Married at First Sight. That's why the networks like sport. I mean, doesn't really matter what something is as long as it brings in the numbers, but sport and reality are those the forms of content best experienced live to air are commercial broadcasters' best hope for hanging on to their audiences in current conditions.
There are, of course, the streamers as well, Anna, and some of them do spend quite a bit of money on scripted Australian dramas and comedies. Stan, for example, is owned wholly at the moment by the Nine Network, and they've invested in programs such as Bump and Bloom and various others. So is that where we need to be looking in terms of spend on Australian dramas and where those cultural stories will be told?
Well, it depends what you mean by where we should be looking, but certainly Stan is doing a lot of heavy lifting in terms of local drama commissioning. I think they did 11 of the 27 streamer titles that went into production last year. The two main sources of drama in Australia now are Stan, which is obviously, as you've just said, an Australian-owned and operated single market streamer, and the ABC. So without those two, there would be extreme, even lower levels of drama production than there are now. But also, let's not forget that I think between all of them, all the services last year did about 70 hours of drama. Now, that's down from what were peaks in the 90s, late 90s, of around 300 to 500 hours just by the commercial broadcasters. So we've seen a catastrophic decline in drama production hours. And I mean, from the production sector's point of view, thank goodness for Stan at the moment.
And I suppose one thing about Stan is that because of its ownership by Nine, then in time we might see some of that content arriving on Nine. But there is a question of that current model of 7, 9 and 10 as the free-to-air broadcasters, and they tend to get some special support from the government with that status. As the model changes, is that the right number of commercial free-to-air broadcasters? Or do you think we might in time see that fall away to just two or just one?
I think given current trends, which are, it's inconceivable that they would be reversed in terms of the drift away from advertising revenue, away from commercial broadcasting. I think they're getting about 16% of the national share in 2022. It's just not feasible for Australia to continue to support three advertiser-funded broadcasters. So, yeah, it probably would make a lot more sense to have two or even one. And then they would be profitable enough to be compelled to resume their former responsibilities to the Australian community in return for free access to Spectrum. They would be compelled to do some pro-social content, such as children's and domestic drama.
The law, of course, would have to change for that because there are some pretty strict laws at the moment around media ownership. So you, effectively, any business can in any city can only own one TV license or two radio licenses. What would be the impetus to change the law to make that sort of change happen?
In terms of what kind of broadcast, free-to-air broadcasting system would we like to see, do you mean?
Yeah. So would it take, for instance, communications policy from the government to say, actually, we need to change the law so that two of these networks could be allowed to merge?
Well, I suppose it depends how proactive the government wants to be in terms of looking at commercial broadcasting, because what we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is governments of all political persuasions being extraordinarily accommodating to commercial broadcasters and to ensuring the survival of all three. And I can understand that in pre-digital conditions, you might be concerned about Australians having access to three free-to-air commercial services. But why we need that now when viewing numbers are falling so dramatically? So I think it's really at what point the government wants to be more proactive rather than being reactive in terms of the regulation of commercial broadcasting. And I guess the second part of that question is, how much do governments still fear the power of commercial broadcasters, the political and social power of commercial broadcasters?
And do they still fear that, Anna?
I don't know. They're behaving as if they do. And it's not incorrect to say that their news services on commercial broadcasters are still, as you would know, some of the highest rating programs in Australia. Not that that means what it used to, given the extent of audience fragmentation. But I think we all saw from the recent election that the media moguls the governments used to be terrified of, in the likes of Kerry Packer and Rupert Murdoch and News Corp and Nine, their power is much diminished. So, but you still need to get your local politicians on the 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock news headlines. So they do behave still as if those companies have enormous political power.
So speaking of politicians, a lot of governments at a state level in particular have been offering tax incentives, offsets and whatnot to get international productions to come and film their shows here. That often means local crews are employed and you might see a cameo or two from an Australian actor. Does that qualify something as Australian content if we're getting to do part of the production, do you think?
The policy rules around what is classified as Australian content are pretty loose in terms of anything to do with Australian culture. So they're what's called the significant Australian content test, or the SAC test, really revolves around the nationalities or the passports of key creatives. So you can have a show like Clickbait that's set in San Francisco and filmed in Melbourne that will be counted as Australian content.
Wasn't The Great Gatsby counted as Australian content?
Elvis, you know, there are many examples. And in drama as well, like Good Cop, Bad Cop on Stan at the moment is set in the US, complete with yellow school buses, but was actually filmed on the Gold Coast. And so, as you say, those attract very generous subsidies from both federal and state governments. The extent to which that delivers value back to the Australian community, I would argue, is debatable, given the very high costs now involved in screen production and the fact that these subsidies are uncapped. And increasingly, the producer offset, for example, in for drama, the amounts accessed have gone up quadrupled in the last 10 years.
So, Anna, why are our politicians willing to subsidise international productions more so than local ones?
Well, I think they're equally willing to subsidise local, but they're not happening. And there's certainly politicians seem to be very attracted by the sort of glamour of the international production circuit and the stars, and they like having their photos taken next to big movie stars. And it all sounds very glamorous and wonderful, but the costs are enormous and increasing and uncapped. And last year, the policy was changed so that location offset, which is used to attract international productions to Australia, is now the same value as the other big tax rebate, which is the producer offset. And so the producer offset has a cultural test, even though it's quite a low cultural bar. The location offset obviously has no cultural test. It's a purely economic measure. So I think we're likely to see those numbers for those rebates are likely to increase quite dramatically, particularly as production costs go up. And I don't think anyone's ever had a really close look at what the benefits are, either economically or culturally, for the very substantial amounts of money that the taxpayer is putting towards the industry at the moment.
And our main thrust of the conversation today obviously has been about spending by the commercial broadcasters, mm-hmm. 7, 9, 10. When it comes to our Australian stories and particularly screen content, is there a bigger role that the ABC could or should be playing, and SBS as well, of course?
Absolutely, 100%. The ABC should sit at the centre of the Australian drama production ecology, and it doesn't, because for a whole host of reasons, including you know, what has been quite inconsistent resourcing in the past. But I find it interesting in all these conversations about putting content obligations on streamers that the ABC is generally left out of those conversations, that the ABC continues to operate without any codified obligations for drama or for children's, actually, which is much more of a risk given the ABC is now really the only source of children, Australian children's television commissions in the country. So yes, the ABC should sit at the centre of this because it is the only free-to-air service, along with SBS, but that has a different remit, serving national audiences. Streamers, apart from Stan and Binge, serve global audiences. They're not interested in Australian culture. Why would they be? So, yes, if we think that we gave $1 billion last year in subsidies to screen production, would some of that be better spent going to the ABC with the mandate to make Australian drama that tells meaningful Australian stories that situate Australians in the national cultural context?
Well, speaking of defunding, unfortunately, the funding for this section has run out. Thank you very much, Anna, for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
And just before we move on, to clarify Anna's comments there about the ABC, SBS and ABC don't have quotas as such for children's and arts content, but they do have internal targets underpinned by their charters. Alrighty, Viv, any other business before we wrap up?
Well, Tim, you might recall last week we spoke about people and their pay in media and how they negotiate or otherwise without knowing what other people are paid. And it seems like for the top end of town, at least, we might have found out what they're earning.
The agents always know.
The Australian dropped its report on television salaries, and there are some big hitters earning big bucks. I think it was Karl Stefanovic on Nine was number one with a $2.8 million salary, followed by Scott Cam on $2.4 million.
Also from Nine for The Block.
And Hamish Blake also on Nine for Lego Masters with $2 million. But, I mean, are these figures true? Where do they get them?
Well, this is the thing. I guess what they do is they ask agents. Now, the issue with that is, of course, the agents know, but also it's in their interest to talk everything up a little bit. So, and I guess, you know, if networks are bidding against each other, they have a pretty good idea. But similarly, this week, we also saw some radio numbers come through, similar guesstimates from the agencies. Mumbrella, which is the organisation I'm one of the owners from, we published some calculations around radio salaries, and they were suggesting that Carl Sanderlands and Jackie Henderson, $10 million each, and that's a number which is well known in the market, with Christian O'Connell the third best paid on something like $5 million. So even bigger salaries in radio than television.
Only at the very, very top end of town, though, surely. Surely the likes of Carl and Jackie O on a deal that has basically broken the radio industry has skewed those numbers somewhat. The reason everybody talks about that figure every other week is because it is so astronomical.
I think we can testify that not everyone in the radio industry has paid those sort of numbers, Viv. Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And we'd love to know what your favourite Australian drama is. Let us know. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you at the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle-pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.